This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Democrats go to the polls today in a primary for the State House seat formerly held by House Speaker Robert DeLeo. Now, normally, State House seats are important to the people in the district, but they don't necessarily garner a lot of attention otherwise. And that would be even more the case when it's an off-cycle special election like this one. But that is not the case for the 19th Suffolk. It's the first time in about three decades that the seat representing Winthrop and Revere is open, and some really big names, from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders to former presidential candidate Julian Castro, are weighing in. So why? Let's ask Stephanie Murray, author of The Politico Massachusetts Playbook. Stephanie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So Stephanie, this is a hot race. Why is it getting so much focus?
This race has, kind of exploded over the last week or so. In particular, there's a historical aspect. The seat was held by Speaker Robert DeLeo, the longest serving speaker in Massachusetts. And the winner of this race obviously won't go on to, be the speaker immediately, at least. There'll be a first-term lawmaker, but there's, a lot of history and kind of a legacy there. It's also a big opportunity, as you said, in the opener. This hasn't been a seat in play for three decades, so certainly some, ambition kind of pent up in Winthrop and Revere, and that's why you see four candidates jumping into this special election race. It's happening on a condensed timeline in an off year, but, it's gathered quite a bit of attention.
So we'll get to the candidates in a minute. I want to stay with this. Why is it a big deal? What you just laid out makes a lot of sense for why it's heated inside the district. But as we said at the top, there are big national names, two former Democratic presidential candidates, for example, and that's just a few of the names weighing in. So why is it so interesting and important outside the district?
Progressives from around the state and even outside are looking at this race as an opportunity to take a seat that was held by a powerful moderate and turn it to a progressive. And progressives have kind of coalesced around Juan Pablo Jaramillo, who is seen as kind of the preferred progressive candidate in the race. Bernie Sanders has endorsed him, Julian Castro, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, three candidates who are running for mayor of Boston. That election is coming in the fall. Not always the case that candidates, running in their own race would jump into another election, but certainly they want to be seen as supporting the progressive candidate. And in 2018, progressives challenged some incumbent lawmakers and had big success. And when they tried that model again in the fall of 2020, some of the progressive primary challengers lost to Democratic incumbents. So they're certainly kind of trying to dust that model off and try again here to add to their ranks on Beacon Hill, especially in the House, still pretty dominated by moderate Democrats.
Yes, I was going to ask you that. Would putting a more progressive candidate in that seat tip the balance in the state house at all? Or is it more just momentum and signaling?
I would say more momentum and signaling. They're, the cohort of progressives is still small compared to the moderates, but their ranks are growing. But it is still a pretty tough uphill climb for Jaramillo, the progressive candidate, because of the way that the district is made up. So it's Winthrop and Revere, but only it's all of Winthrop and then part of Revere, and he's from Revere, while the other three Democrats running are from Winthrop, which historically has higher turnout, which might give them an edge, even though they're kind of splitting up the city a little bit.
Okay, so you've told us a little bit about Juan Jaramillo, the really progressive candidate from Revere. Tell us about these three Democratic candidates from Winthrop.
So you have Jeffrey Turco, who describes himself as a Reagan Democrat. He is the most kind of conservative Democrat of the bunch. He has been hit by NARAL pro-choice for some past anti-abortion comments he's made. And he is, for example, opposed to the Safe Communities Act, which is an immigration bill in Massachusetts. The three other Democrats running support it, for example. So he's kind of seen as the more conservative candidate. He's also the best or the most well-funded in the race. He's given his campaign $25,000, which is quite a bit, especially in one of these special state legislative elections. So there's Turco, and then you have Alicia Del Vento, also of Winthrop, who is a former state house aide, and Valentino Capobianco, who was on the Winthrop School Committee, and he was recently accused of sexual misconduct in a story from GVH News last week. In the final kind of days of the race that happened, some were wondering if he would drop out. He has denied most of the allegations, but has stayed in the race.
I just a little bit from his statement in response to those allegations, quote, "It is deeply personally embarrassing to see some dumb college behavior also be raised. I will own my own mistakes. I was not predatory. I was overly enthusiastic texting someone I had a crush on. That is juvenile behavior of a nerdy kid." It's a longer statement, so obviously addressing those things head on, but it has affected his standing in the race and endorsements of the candidates, has it not?
That's right. He lost endorsements from Attorney General Maura Healey and Congressman, former Congressman Joe Kennedy, and his former boss. So Capobianco used to be the chief of staff to State Senator Paul Feeney. Feeney also withdrew his endorsement in the wake of these allegations becoming public.
All right. And again, unusual to see endorsements at that level, at the Maura Healey level, for example, of a state house race. And is it unusual to see major politicians in the state withdraw or have to drop an endorsement?
Yeah, this is certainly, you know, a level of attention and scrutiny on a state representative race compared to others. And these special elections are also pretty common. A Mass Inc. report has pointed out that more than a quarter of the entire state legislature is elected through these special elections, you know, happening on an off year because somebody left office, resigned, retired, moved on, something like that. It's also, I just want to underscore how few votes it takes to win one of these races. Turnout is pretty low compared to a presidential election or, you know, regularly scheduled elections. So the winner of this primary and in this deep blue district, most of the action will be in the primary. The winner is expected to probably win in the general election on March 30th. You can kind of get through with 10,000, 15,000 votes.
Do you get a sense that depending on who the candidate is, that might affect turnout in the general election?
That's a good question. I am not sure. So there are two candidates running in the general election as well, Republican Paul Crugio and the independent candidate Richard Fusillo. But it really does feel like the attention is on the primary here.
Okay, before we let you go, I do want to shift gears and spend a couple of minutes on another thing that we're watching, and I know you're watching, and that is that Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone announced yesterday that he would not run for another term. He has served about 18 years as the mayor of Somerville. I believe he's the longest serving executive in the history of that city. He told WBUR's Bob Oakes this morning it's too early for him to decide his next step, but there's a lot of speculation going on. So two-part question. Part one, were you surprised to hear Curtatone say almost a year before the end of his term that he's not going to run again?
I think it's certainly interesting. He got asked this question yesterday if he was thinking about running for governor in 2022. You know, if he were to do that, this is kind of a convenient time to start ramping down as mayor and preparing for someone else. But he called that question science fiction. Of course, never say never. He has emerged as one of the loudest critics to Governor Charlie Baker over the coronavirus pandemic, the handling of it, and the handling of the vaccine rollout over the past month or two. So he's someone I would certainly keep an eye on for that.
Has he given any reason for choosing not to run for mayor again?
I mean, that's kind of what I'm wondering. I mean, he's been mayor for quite some time, I think since 2004. And he actually kind of fits in with a trend of a bunch of mayors across the state who are saying that they're not going to seek another term. There's Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse, who just got tapped to be the Provincetown Town Administrator, the mayor of North Adams, the mayor of Northampton, the mayor of Lawrence just left to take a job, a state government job. And of course, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is on his way to becoming Secretary of Labor in the Biden administration. So he fits into this kind of trend of mayors moving on.
All right. Well, that is Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook. Stephanie, great to watch the races with you, or the maybe the races yet to come. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Now, you might remember that yesterday we talked about reopening. The state began to allow indoor performance venues and recreation centers to open at reduced capacity. The state further loosened restrictions on restaurants. Well, it's a confusing time because at the same time that's happening, and the FDA has authorized a new vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, for emergency use, we also have the head of the CDC cautioning against reopening. We are seeing increases in cases from the new coronavirus variants. We're hearing about more new coronavirus variants, but we also hear about the business deal between Merck and Johnson & Johnson to drive up vaccine production. So it can raise a lot of questions about where we are and what we should do next for Massachusetts residents. Let's see if we can answer your questions. It's time for an Ask the Doctors. We have a panel of local health experts here to help you. What do you need to know? Whether that's to make the best informed decisions you can about whether to take advantage of the reopening, how to keep your loved ones safe, how to think about kids being in school, questions about the vaccine as you try to sign up to get a vaccine or as you wait for your turn in the phases. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us today, we have Dr. Shira Derone, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at the Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Mark Seidner, clinical epidemiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and an associate professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Doctors Derone and Seidner, thanks to both of you.
Always a pleasure.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. So, Dr. Derone, I'll turn to you. Just your take today on the next step in reopening that the Commonwealth took yesterday.
Well, I am an optimist, and so I'm going to see that as a step towards normalcy, which we all want. We have a lot of things to be hopeful about. We have declining case rates, and we have our newest vaccine. So those are good things. And, of course, I'm a cautious optimist because I am worried that the numbers are leveling off a bit, and I'm, you know, of course worried about variants, but I'm hoping that we'll overcome all of that.
So before I go to Dr. Seidner, just a quick follow-up. The numbers are leveling off here, even here in the Commonwealth, but we're still seeing them in the 1,000-plus range. I do remember a time over the summer when they were dramatically lower. So is leveling the right metric, do you think, Dr. Derone? Is that what we should be looking at? Is it the trend line, or is it the absolute number of cases per day? How to think about that?
No, I'd certainly like to see our cases continue to go down, and I wish the slope were as steep as it was a few weeks ago. So leveling may be an issue. Now, we do have more testing capacity now, even than we did in the summer, and increasingly, what we're going to see is that a larger proportion of our cases are going to be occurring in people who are vaccinated, who are partially immune from vaccine and infection, and who are less vulnerable, not vaccinated, and therefore less vulnerable. And so we really at some point need to shift our attention to hospitalizations as a more important metric.
So, Dr. Mark Seidner, turning to you, and let me just throw the number out again for our listeners, 800-423-8255 to ask your question. Dr. Seidner, what are the metrics most important to you right now, and how do you think we're doing against them?
Yeah, I have to agree with Dr. Derone. I do think that one of the most important metrics to track is how full are our hospitals and how full are our intensive care units. It's really when our hospitals fill up and our intensive care units fill up that we're unable to care for people, both with COVID-19 infection and with other medical problems that really range across the healthcare system. We have seen declines in those numbers pretty distinctly over the last few weeks and months. Most of the ICUs across the Commonwealth are now capable of taking on more individuals. And so that has to be a primary metric by which we're able to say, can we take on an increase in cases? The other thing that I think is instructive is the percent positivity rate, and that also we've seen come down to less than 2% for the first time since last year. So we do need to keep our eyes on things, and I'll say, just like she did, that this is a time to be somewhat optimistic. It's nice to see cases down, to see hospitalizations down, but this is not a one-way street, and I think we need to be incredibly careful as we ease restrictions to know that if cases go back up, if case positivity goes back up, if our hospitalization rate go back up, we may need to turn back around. This is not a permission slip to return to 2019. This is a slow easing of restrictions with careful attention to the numbers.
That's going to really stick with me because I would love a permission slip to return to 2019. I think we all would, but it's an excellent point. Let me go to the phones. Let's take our first call, 800-423-8255. We've got Monica on the line in Franklin. Monica, what's your question?
Hi, I'm a mom and my daughter's in elementary school. I'm wondering about whether it's really safe to have the children at 3 feet distance with the new variants and with everything opening up. Thank you.
Thanks, Monica. Dr. Seidner, I'll just stay right with you. The 3 feet ruling, that's not the right word, guideline for schools. What about that?
Yeah, I think the data is really accruing, especially in younger kids. So this really pertains to elementary school kids, not necessarily to older kids, that being in school with masks on and with protective measures, hand washing and some level of distancing has really not led to large school-wide outbreaks. And I think we need to be reassured by that data. I think the risks of keeping kids out of school, I think, are pretty extreme. And just like with easing of restrictions, the very important thing that we continue to monitor schools themselves. And the state has done a pretty good job of keeping track of infections within schools. We need to keep our eyes on those numbers. And if we find things change, if cases do go up in schools, if we find outbreaks in schools, especially as the city of Boston and other return to school, we have to be willing to turn around and change strategy. So I think I'm pretty comfortable with the CDC and other recommendations, to especially for younger kids, to go back to school with the current limitations in place. But let's not forget that things can change at any minute. Let's be vigilant and see how things go.
Dr. Shira-Giron, is there anything you'd want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, 3 feet of distance, or I should say 1 meter, which is approximately 3 feet, is a standard in many parts of the world. Europe and Asia have been, many countries in those areas have had schools open throughout the pandemic, or certainly throughout the school year, with great success. We have a need because of our need to create rules and guidelines to make things binary when they are actually on a continuum. And certainly the virus doesn't carry a yardstick, and the risk increases with decreasing distance. The risk increases with increasing time, but our definitions, for example, that we use for exposure, like 6 feet, 15 minutes, they're relatively arbitrary. So I do believe that at this point, with it being so important to get children back to school, that a 3 foot rule makes a lot of sense.
Let's grab another call, 800-423-8255 for Amanda in Danvers. Amanda, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. So my husband and I contracted COVID at the end of December, and we were released from quarantine, I think it was around the 10th or so of January. So my question is, do we wait 90 days for a vaccine?
Dr. Giron.
Yeah, so I get this question a lot, and people do find the guidance on that confusing. The CDC basically puts it in your hands to decide, given the fact that immunity after COVID infection is pretty good, and it's pretty good for at least 90 days. Probably for most people, longer than 90 days, but for at least 90 days, you have pretty solid immunity. And so you may simply choose to wait, first of all, to give other people a chance to get vaccine, but also things are changing. New vaccines are coming out, there's new knowledge accruing, and maybe there will be something different about vaccination in a few months than there is now, and you may want to avail yourself of the new knowledge that we gain.
So, Dr. Mark Seidner, we also had a question from Lucy, who didn't want to put her voice on air, but this is a question I think we'll have others interested in, too. Lucy says that she's a COVID-19 long hauler and wonders if she should get the vaccine or if it could trigger symptoms for her to do so.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's also one that we get quite a bit. For the most part, we're still learning what this long haul syndrome is and what it entails and who it affects and how it affects. And there are some large NIH studies that are just starting now to give us a much better understanding of what exactly it is. My general recommendation for most people who become eligible for the vaccine is to speak with their physician or the provider about the risks and benefits of it. I do think that from the information we have now, for the vast majority of people, the benefits of vaccination are going to outweigh the risks. And that's because we know quite clearly that these vaccines in the vast majority of people, especially including those who've been infected in the past, are safe, they're effective, and they protect people from getting clinical COVID, which is sickness with COVID or being hospitalized with COVID. So again, it needs to be on a case-by-case basis. And I think if you have concerns, you should talk to your provider. But what we're generally seeing now, having vaccinated tens of millions of people in this country, is that the vaccines definitely the benefits outweigh the risks in the vast majority of people.
All right, let's keep taking calls, 1-800-423-8255, to ask your coronavirus or coronavirus vaccine question. We've got Mary on the line in Franklin. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering how to interact with my father-in-law or how to visit him now that he is fully immunized. He lives alone, and he has he only sees his immediate family, and usually it's one-on-one. Do I have to continue to wear a mask?
Mary, let me just ask you, have you had vaccination yet?
No.
Okay. So Dr. Durone, to you.
Yeah, so this is a really important question because there hasn't been a lot of guidance for people about what to do once they're immunized or vaccinated. But the CDC is planning to release something this week. So there may be a lot of information there that you'll be able to digest. But the way I advise people is, again, risk is going to be on a continuum, and you're always going to be able to improve that risk by wearing a mask and keeping, you know, 6 feet or so of distance outside, well-ventilated spaces. All of those things will continue to decrease your risk because vaccination is definitely not 100%, although it's excellent. And the fact that the more vulnerable person in your situation is the vaccinated one, that adds a level of protection as well. It's better that the vulnerable person is vaccinated as opposed to the vulnerable person being unvaccinated and the less vulnerable person being vaccinated. Certainly, if all people are vaccinated in a group, that's the safest situation. So safest outside, with masks, with distance, all people vaccinated. And then everything else is sort of some level of risk, but much, much less than in the days before vaccination existed.
This is an Ask the Doctors on Radio Boston. We're taking your coronavirus questions with Dr. Shira Durone of Tufts Medical Center and Dr. Mark Seidner of Massachusetts General Hospital. We've got Vito on the line from the North End. The number, by the way, is 800-423-8255. Vito, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering about the context of the reporting of the numbers. I realize the numbers are going down, total numbers, but there's never much comment about the severity of these cases. For instance, I think there's about 32,000 current cases, less than 800 in the hospital. That tells me about 2.5% are recovering at home. It just seems that there's never any context to the total amount of numbers, and I think people just assume the worst. And I think that affects decisions and such, and I'm just a little frustrated that there's never any comment about, you know, are these very mild? Are they home with the sniffles, a couple of days of fever? I mean, I just think that more information in the context of severity would go a long way.
Thanks for the call, Vito. Do we track severity levels in our data tracking, Drs. Durone and Seidner? And what is your reaction to Vito's call? Happy to let either of you take that.
Yeah, sure. I can take a stab at it to begin with. I think the best way to track that data is actually to follow case reports along with hospitalization rates and fatality rates. So how many people for each infection are being hospitalized and how many are dying of the disease. And what we've seen, at least historically over the last few months, is actually those numbers in Massachusetts have been pretty stable. So the same amount, about 5-10% of people get hospitalized. And in terms of the reported cases, it's about 1%. Are suffering death. So those numbers haven't changed much. We do expect over the next 2 or 3 months for those numbers to start to change. And why is that? That's because as our vaccination rates go up, especially amongst vulnerable populations, people older than 75, people older than 65 as it expands, people with comorbidities, there will be infections that occur, but for the most part, the vulnerable population will be protected from severe disease. So what I think we're going to start to see is that the hospitalization rates do start to go down, and the mortality rate starts to go down. And that's really a sign that these vaccines are working. And it's what we've been waiting for the last year. I think we're still a month or two from getting there until we get vaccination rates up to like 30, 40, 50%. But that should be in our future. And I think it will be a welcome coming as it does come.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. We have Kristen on the line in Waltham. Go ahead, Kristen.
Hi, thank you. Hi, thanks. I'm a teacher outside of Boston, a science teacher. And I heard the comment earlier about elementary schools. Can you comment on the safety around 3 feet for middle school and specifically high school students? And I was interested in the time guidelines being somewhat arbitrary, as you mentioned. I'd love to hear your thoughts on 85-minute-long classes with about 125 students per day.
All right, Dr. Durone, how about back to you for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. There are a lot of factors that are going to increase and decrease the level of risk. So with increasing age, children are more likely to be infected and more likely to be transmitters of infection. With time, statistically, with every minute you spend with someone who has COVID, you're risk of acquiring COVID goes up, just as with every minute you spend driving 100 miles an hour on the highway, your risk of an accident goes up. So, you know, that is, again, there are no binary numbers there. It's just all on a continuum. However, like I said, there has been a great amount of experience with children of all ages, with entire schools back to school in other countries in particular, not being able to sit 6 feet apart, sitting about 1 meter or three, a little bit more than 3 feet apart with no in-school transmission. Because when you layer the masking on top of that, when you layer surface disinfection and hand hygiene and good ventilation where possible, although certainly we're talking about school districts with all kinds of levels of quality of their air handling systems too. So we're not talking about school districts necessarily with the highest level HVAC. There has been very little transmission. And I feel that at this point, the kids really deserve a chance to be back in school and show that they can do it and that the schools can remain safe even with more children in the classrooms.
Thanks for that answer, Dr. Durone. And I do want to give our listeners some numbers. Vito, one of our callers, talked about estimated cases and hospitalizations. As of yesterday, we think the estimate from the state is 30,486 active cases. And we're pulling numbers for you on hospitalizations. I'll give you those a little later in the hour. Looks like we are in the 800 range, but we'll give you, in fact, 788. That's right. Okay, so let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David has a question from Lexington. David, go ahead.
Hi. My vitamin D level in my blood is 55 nanograms per milliliter, which I presume is a lot higher than the average American who's deficient or really lacking. And I'm wondering if I should get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which has, I think, a 55% efficacy level. Is it likely to be more so for me because of that vaccine, because of that vitamin D level or not?
Thank you for the call, David. And just to clarify, in trials, the Johnson & Johnson's efficacy level in the United States is 72% overall, 66% globally. So just to clarify there. And Dr. Seidner, maybe you can talk about vitamin D in general. We get questions about vitamin D from our listeners a lot, and then more specifically address that question. Oh, we may have lost. Do we have Dr. Mark Seidner? Okay, Dr. Durone, do we still have you?
You do.
You are back on until we get Dr. Seidner back on the phone again.
Okay, so vitamin D. So, you know, as we've probably talked about before, there seems to be an association between low vitamin D levels or vitamin D deficiency and worse outcomes from COVID-19, but you can't supplement that problem away. So supplementing vitamin D doesn't seem to improve one's outcomes from COVID-19, so it's not exactly clear how that association works. In terms of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, we cannot say that it's less efficacious than the mRNA vaccines Moderna and Pfizer because it wasn't studied head-to-head against either of those. It wasn't studied in the same type of circumstances. It wasn't studied at the same time of the pandemic or in the same parts of the world or in the context of the same variants. And so all we know is the efficacy from one trial versus the efficacy from the other trials, but you can't, they are apples to oranges if you were to try to compare them. And as a result, the CDC and the, they just really released their guidelines in the last hour. They are making no recommendations for one or the other vaccine for any specific population, with the possible exception that if you really want to just be done with it and have one shot, certainly you could seek out the Janssen, Johnson & Johnson vaccine, although some vaccine centers are not going to tell you until you get there what vaccine they're offering that day. And I would plan, I would expect that to be sort of the rule rather than the exception.
So before we go back to the phones, I want to stay on that for a second. I think we do have Dr. Mark Seidner back. Dr. Seidner, are you there?
I am, yes. Sorry about that.
No, not at all. So just to underscore what Dr. Durome was just saying, we have heard conversation increasing over the last few days about whether or not one should seek a particular vaccine. And of course, what the administration, the Baker administration is saying, and what we're hearing at the national level is the point right now is to get vaccinated, not to vaccine shop. Just underscoring that and asking you, would that be your recommendation as well?
Absolutely. I think we need to treat these vaccines as the privilege that they are. I think certainly 6 months ago, if someone had said there's three vaccine candidates, all of which protect against clinical infection, getting people sick at 85% or better, not many of us would have believed that information, especially now that we have experience giving tens of millions of people these vaccines with really no severe side effects in terms of deaths or hospitalizations due to the vaccine themselves. So all three of these vaccines in very well-designed clinical trials protected people from getting sick with COVID 85% of the time or better. There were no deaths in any of the arms of people who got the vaccine in any of these studies. I think they're exceptional vaccines. I think we need to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. And however the distribution plans work to allow that to happen, I think we should support. And there doesn't seem to me any clear distinction between getting one versus the other because they all work quite well and they're all quite safe.
All right. Calls are still coming in, 1-800-423-8255 to get on the line with Drs. Mark Seidner and Shira Durone. We've got Richard from Back Bay. Richard, what's your question?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
I can, Richard. Go
ahead. Can you
hear
me?
Yeah.
Great. I'm curious to know if I've had both my shots, whether it's Pfizer or Moderna, and the booster is recommended, does it matter which I get? Can I get a Pfizer if I had Moderna, or if I had Moderna, is it okay to get Pfizer booster?
Thanks for the question, Richard. And Dr. Durone, I'll ask you to start by answering where we are on the idea of boosters from Moderna and Pfizer, and then Richard's question about would it matter which one you got?
Yeah, we're still a ways away from any kind of plan that might involve vaccinated people getting revaccinated, boosted, different vaccine. At this point, the companies that make the vaccines are planning for a variety of scenarios related to immune-evading variants. So they're working on boosters. They're working on different formulations. There are no recommendations for anybody to receive additional vaccines when they're done with their one- or two-shot series. More recommendations will be forthcoming if that becomes the case. Right now, the CDC recommends not mixing and matching at all if you're doing a two-shot series, but we'll have to see what happens down the road. Hopefully none of that will come to be necessary at all.
And before I go back to the phones, I'd love to just hear one of you talk a little bit more about, as the new variants come, will there be a regular race to adapt the current vaccines, kind of like there is every year? The flu shot has a variation every year depending on what we think the dominant strain is going to be. Do we have any idea what to expect from that perspective yet? Maybe stay with me, Dr. Durone, on that.
You know, this coronavirus and others, they're not really like the flu shot. They don't mutate as quickly. We don't expect to have to adapt the vaccine on an annual basis in that same way. We were so excited to see the Janssen, Johnson & Johnson vaccine efficacy against the variants in South America and South Africa, that it was still essentially 100% effective against hospitalization and death. And with data like that, it's likely that we wouldn't need any change in the formulation or booster against variants. But time will tell.
All right, that's encouraging. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Greg in Dedham. Greg, what's your question?
Hi, I have a question about medication, both specific and more general. One, I'm lined up to take a cortisone shot in my spine with lidocaine, and I put it off just because I wasn't sure if there's a mix. I've already had my first shot, and I have my second shot in 2 weeks. How long?
When you say your first shot, Greg, you mean your first vaccine shot? And so you put off the lidocaine?
That's right, my first Moderna.
Okay.
I put on my first shot of Moderna, and then I have one more shot in 2 weeks, and I put off the lidocaine cortisone treatment. And I also want to know if it's all right to take Advil in more general terms.
So let's go to you, Dr. Mark Seidner, and you may or may not feel like you can answer Greg's question directly. If you can, great. But also, how do people find out more information about interactions between other medications or treatments and vaccines?
Sure, great questions. I might try to answer the second one first, because that's one we get quite a bit about taking things like Advil or non-steroidals or Tylenol around the time of a vaccine. What we typically recommend to people is that if you take those medicines regularly for a chronic condition, that you should continue them. The vaccine itself shouldn't necessarily have you stop taking them. But for pretty much everyone else, so if you don't normally take those medicines, don't take them preemptively before the vaccine just because you're worried you might have side effects. Go ahead, get the vaccine. And if you do have side effects that are significantly bothersome, headaches, myalgias, fevers, where you feel like those medicines can be helpful, it's perfectly fine to take them. Participants in these vaccine trials did take them, and we've seen high efficacy in these studies despite their use. So we don't tell people to avoid them after the fact if they have symptoms, just not to take them preemptively before they take the vaccine because of fear of side effects. In terms of other interactions with the vaccines, I think it's important to note that at least the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines really don't have too many components in them other than some basically fat particles and particles that are already in our body. And so we haven't really seen too much any evidence at all of those vaccines interacting with other medicines. And so we typically would tell most patients to talk to your doctor if you have specific questions about any medicines that you're taking before and around a vaccine. So I don't want to give any specific recommendations. But for the most part, these vaccines don't appear to interact with most medicines.
So, Dr. Durone, I want to stay on this question from the caller for a minute because Dr. Seidner just talked about not taking something prophylactically because you're worried about side effects. I know we do. The public health goal is for as many people to get vaccinated as possible. So maybe you can address the concern about side effects. What are the real concerns? What are we really seeing? How severe are those side effects? How often do they happen, et cetera?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are nervous about the side effects from these vaccines, and I have to be honest, I was nervous before my second shot, too. I didn't want to be up all night with shaking chills and sweats, and in fact, I wasn't, and I came to work the next day, and I'm just one story, but I think we hear about the people who feel really sick after that vaccine. When we talk, and they aren't the majority. They are the minority. But when I talk to those people, they say, you know, I told myself this is evidence that the vaccine is working. This is evidence that the vaccine is revving up my immune system so that it will recognize the virus. And it was fine, and it was over in a day. And I feel bulletproof now. So, you know, it does come with the territory. It's probably not as bad as you think it's going to be. And it resolves quickly.
All right. Well, that is Dr. Shira Durone of Tufts Medical Center and Dr. Mark Seidner of Massachusetts General Hospital. Thanks to you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. For sports fans, sports are a joy and an escape. And in really tough times, they can become a rallying point, even for maybe the non-ball and stick oriented among us. And that has been so true here in Boston, especially over the last 20 years when our teams have been ascendant, especially during some deeply challenging times for the rest of us. Remember David Ortiz speaking to Red Sox fans on the day Fenway reopened after the marathon bombing.
This is a city. And nobody gonna dictate our freedom. Stay strong. Thank you.
As Big Papi also said that day, he said the jerseys don't say Red Sox, they say Boston. We have spent the last year dealing with some really dark times, and grim realities. It's been hard. So we need that escape more than ever. But is it still here for us in Boston sports? Let's check the score on that with Radio Boston's Chris Siderik. Hey there, Chris.
Oh, got chills, Tiziana. Chills. What a moment.
You know, me too, Chris. And I was thinking about it because we had had Red Sox tickets the game was canceled because of the bombing and rescheduled for that day. So my husband and my kids and I were in the stadium in Fenway when Big Papi made that speech. One of my kids is a baseball fan. The other one isn't. But we all remember that moment. We all valued that moment because of the sense of community and resilience that it gave us. It, you know, we were being together. And then for the sports fan, there was also this sense that the Red Sox could win for us that day and that victory would be great. What is it about sports that helps us transcend our toughest moments?
Yeah, I love you use the word resilience there because I think sports has this unique ability that when you're watching something special, you actually can tell in the moment, this is something that's truly going to be special and something that's going to be iconic throughout the city or the team franchise's history. And, you know, David Ortiz that day in five words, I think, really captured what so much of Boston and New England was feeling. And, you know, you say it's the first time fans were back in Fenway. It was less than 24 hours since the manhunt had ended. And, you know, folks were hurt and scared and confused and angry. And yet in five words, Ortiz kind of brings it all into clarity and taps into that communal resiliency. And I think it was just such a powerful moment. And it makes me think of a moment from actually earlier that same week. On Wednesday, 2 days after the bombing, the Bruins had a game at the Garden. And there was kind of a back and forth. Should they play? Should they not? And I will never forget Rene Rencourt, who for years sang the anthem at Bruins games. Here he is 2 days after the marathon bombing. Just listen to the emotion in his voice as he starts the anthem. And then as the crowd comes in to lift him up, he just lowers the mic.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proud?
This is 2 days after the bombing, and you've got 17,000 plus people singing along. And so you'd imagine, okay, as they're going through this anthem, they're probably going to get a little disjointed. Tempo's not going to be quite right. Folks are going to fade out. But just listen to the energy of the crowd as they come to a close. I mean, just absolutely electric. The crowd breaks out into a USA chant as the cheers fade, and the Bruins go all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals a couple of months later. It really was just such a source of inspiration for folks all over the region.
So there's more to this, Chris, and I do want to note the Sox were strong that year. You've got the Bruins going all the way to the Stanley Cup. There's more history there of resilience after tough times when a Boston sports team was great when we needed them to be. Take us back to really the first time in that run.
Yeah, the first instance is really interesting to me because it wasn't just for Boston or for New England. It was actually for the country. And I'm going to say the Patriots, which immediately folks are going to think, no way, the country was rooting for the Patriots. But take yourself back to February 2002, Super Bowl 36. This is just 5 months after the attacks on September 11th. You remember the halftime show that year. U2 performed this emotional version of Where the Streets Have No Names, and all the names of the 9/11 victims were scrolling across the backdrop. But to the game itself, you know, the Patriots were 14-point underdogs against the Rams, coming off a 5-11 season the year before. So they weren't even supposed to compete with this team. You know, the Rams were called the greatest show on turf. They were this offensive juggernaut. Something about this team was so special. I really want to tap into it. So back in the day, for years and years during the Super Bowl, teams would announce their players one by one and folks would individually come into the stadium. And the Rams did just that in February 2002. Here's a little bit of what that sounded like.
And wide receiver from North Carolina State, number 88, Torrey Holmes.
So you have the Rams offense come out player by player, and everybody takes their victory lap. And then all of a sudden, this happens.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, choosing to be introduced as a team, here are the American Football Conference champions, the New England Patriots.
So again, pretty staggering to hear folks cheering for the Patriots like that. You don't hear that anymore. Yeah. But, I mean, this game was just so symbolic of the time. It's a tight battle back and forth. It's tied 17-17. Tom Brady, who at that point is a sixth-round draft pick, backup quarterback, who's only there because Drew Bledsoe got hurt, drives his team down the field as time expires. Adam Vinatieri hits a 48-yard field goal with 0 seconds left on the clock. Red, white, and blue confetti explodes all over the field and rains down on players and fans. And it really did feel like an absolute triumph for the country in that moment.
So, Chris, you know, I've got goosebumps. I'm remembering all of that. It really does underscore that whether you're a sports fan or not, there is this thing that sports and victory and somebody to root for can do for us. That was 20 years of greatness for Boston sports teams. We are in a tough, tough time now, a year into a pandemic. And you and I wanted to do this today because we're asking the question, can Boston sports do that for us now?
Yeah, it really does feel like we need it now more than ever. And you know me, I'm an eternal optimist. I'm 100% a homer. So I want to believe that it is still here within the Boston teams. There are plenty of folks who are saying Boston's run is definitely over. It's done. I'm not sure exactly who the best hope is, which is really interesting. You've got the Bruins are playing pretty well, but they've had a couple of tough finishes the last couple of years. You know, 2 years ago, they went game seven of the Stanley Cup Finals. We talked about what a missed opportunity that was. And then last year, they have the season get shut down and then restarted a few months later. They were crushing during the regular season, couldn't quite recapture that rhythm. So I think a lot of folks were hoping the Celtics would really pick this up. You've got two young superstars that are potentially two of the best players in the league, but they really just haven't captured that team chemistry that it takes to kind of take them to that next level.
And they could, you think?
I do. They're still so, so young. I think people are ready to write this team off and say we need to blow it up and shake things up. But, you know, they haven't had all their guys healthy. They've been missing Marcus Smart for a while. Not to say Marcus Smart is the answer to everything. But he does bring, I think, what this team is so sorely lacking right now. And that's a sense of accountability, a sense of toughness. You really need players to be able to fight for each other and to be greater than just the sum of their talents, to act as a cohesive unit. And hopefully a guy with that kind of intensity can start to hold these guys accountable to each other. And you also hope to see Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown continue to develop as young superstars and maybe take on a greater leadership role as they grow.
But that means we are asking a lot of our athletes to carry us through these times, Chris.
We are. And I, you know, it was something I was thinking a lot about as actually we were watching the Tiger Woods story play out over the last week or so. Tiger was in a terrible car accident last week and had to be removed with the jaws of life and, you know, shattered his right leg. And for about 24, 48 hours, all we knew was that he had critical injuries. But so much of the writing was about, will he come back? Will he play golf again?
Yeah.
I just think it's so important to remember these are people, these are humans who are feeling the same things we're feeling.
Well, and sometimes they lift us up outside of ourselves. That's Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek. Chris, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.